Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Divorce rates in the U.S. have been on the decline in recent years, but within those separations, research out of UW-Madison showed a shift in the placement of children from those divorces. Back in the 1980s, just 2% of divorces in Wisconsin resulted in equal joint custody of children. The vast majority of divorces had one parent gain sole custody, maybe with visitation rights. Jump ahead to the 2010s, that number jumped up to about a third of divorces leading to joint custody. Other studies have shown similar trends nationwide. But a lot of our social safety net and child support systems are still designed with one household in mind. Our next guest researches family characteristics and public policy. He's here to help us learn more about how these custody systems work and how they could be improved. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one gone through a child custody split? What was that experience like? What do you think of the current child support system? And if you're in a family with joint and equal custody, has that created difficulties in dealing with things like bureaucracy at any level? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Quentin Reiser is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at UW-Madison. Quentin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you for having me.
Quentin, when a couple is getting divorced or a non-married couple with kids is splitting up, what are the factors that go into determining custody placement of children?
Yeah, so I always sort of begin from this premise that courts and families sometimes make decisions around where a child should be placed in the event of a divorce or a separation. And there are a lot of factors. One you can imagine is how well off the family is. So a lot of times when we think about this phenomenon of shared care increasing over time, and you cited the statistic that talked about equal care, but when we think about joint physical custody, whether it be symmetric, which is roughly 50-50, or asymmetric, where both parents have at least 25% of their time with the child, but it's some sort of variation on 50-50, maybe 45-55, that has increased from roughly 12.5% to roughly a third, as you said. And now, if we look at those data, most recent data show that over half of custody arrangements in the U.S. are shared. And so it's true that when we think about shared custody, there's this selection effect where traditionally more affluent, more highly educated parents selected into this arrangement. And one of the reasons that you can think that might be true is because this arrangement, the shared care arrangement, is a costly arrangement. You can think about fixed costs such as housing. If the child's going to have a bedroom in parent A and parent B's home, well, then that duplicates the cost, essentially. There's actually data from Australia that estimates that a shared care child is roughly 70% of a child in each home. And so now you have like 1.5 children with the same level of income, presumably, for both parents. So income is one factor that is a consideration when parents are opting for one custody arrangement or the other. One important dimension that I think about in my research is the extent to which the parents can cooperate. I think custody type notwithstanding, that cooperation or conflict is critical in shaping developmental outcomes, and we can get a bit more into that later. So it's really the things that come up immediately when you ask that is, you know, how well off is the family? Are they a family of means? And how well do the co-parents get along, essentially?
Well, that's interesting because that means, in effect, there's a built-in inequity on that. If you have, let's suppose, a lower-income couple who do get along and would love to have equal custody of their kids, there might just straight up be a financial impossibility. They couldn't afford together to maintain two households big enough to support those kids.
Certainly. And so you can and I think a lot of it, what we would point to is those fixed costs like housing. I mean, certainly there are time dependent costs such as food or, maybe utilities, depending upon how much, water, I guess, or what have you that the child is using when they're staying in your home. But, lower income families would often struggle, at times to maintain one household. And so when you break into two households and you lose sort of these economies of scale, it becomes much more difficult to sustain that arrangement. And I think it's also important to point out that lower income families are not really always what we're talking about when we conduct these studies on joint physical custody. And that's mainly because lower income families are more likely to cohabitate than to marry. And so when we're thinking about the cohort of families that have been divorced, I mean, this is already of the baseline of families that have children, sort of a more socioeconomically advantaged group compared to the counterparts who cohabitate. And so always, too, it's important to kind of note that while there's this sort of positive selection, as I've suggested, into shared care relative to sole care, such that those that enter into the shared care arrangement typically have higher incomes and are more educated, there's actually a negative selection into divorce, right? Such that those who divorce have lower incomes and are commonly less educated than their counterparts who remain in stable marriages. And so it's a really complex dynamic to study these phenomenon of divorcing and separating parents and how children should fare in each of these arrangements when you think about all of the possibilities. So it's something that, you know, that we all try to disentangle.
Talking to Quentin Reiser, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, about joint custody of children, how it works differently, maybe at different income levels in our country. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Quentin, I wonder, with families who are not married, you know, cohabiting, maybe raising kids, when they separate, they're not married, so they don't get divorced. Are there cases where, hey, we're just figuring out our child raising system without going to the courts and maybe without researchers being able to research it?
Well, that is true, yes. But it's also true among shared care families. It's true in some data. We worked on a study. This was actually an international comparative study contrasting data from Wisconsin, which represented the U.S. in this case, and Finland. And we assessed the extent to which shared care families, relative to sole care families, shared an array of expenses. And we looked at, like, expenses such as hobbies and health insurance and a series of expenses, and asking the question, do shared care families share expenses? But a part of that study that we assessed was, are shared care families more likely or less likely to have a formal child support agreement? Or do they sort of, as you suggested about maybe lower income families that are cohabitating, handle things among themselves? And it's true that shared care families, as we found, are more likely to kind of handle things among themselves. And when you think about lower income families and potentially parent A or parent B attempting to support the child or attempting to establish a level of time with the child, there is also some of that we see. That's not something that empirically I've investigated, but there are others that have that suggest that, yes, sometimes it is more arm's length than it is, let's get the courts involved in determining legal and physical custody arrangement.
We're talking to UW-Madison Human Development and Family Studies Professor Quentin Reiser about an increase in joint child custody, how it fits into child support and other systems. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you dealt with this in your life? Did you come up with an amicable shared custody arrangement with the help of courts or without? Join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Quentin Reiser, Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at UW-Madison, looking at how our social safety net systems work for children in different custody arrangements after their parents separate. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Brian is with us in Rice Lake. Brian, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to share my experience 5 years ago during my divorce. I filed for placement of my daughter, and I also filed for child support. And what I found in Barron County here where I live is that when I filled out the forms, I really couldn't. We had to audit the edit the forms so that we had to scratch out wife, mother, because there was nowhere for male husband, you know, father to put his name on the form when we submitted it. And I also felt when I was in court, I had an experience with the judge and said, hey, sure is really great, you know, that a man wants to have his child, and he applauded me, and then he further insulted me by saying, and it sure is great that a husband or a man would want to have his daughter. And it really hurt my feelings.
Brian, I'm sorry to hear that. Thank you for sharing that experience. Quentin, as I understand in American history, there was early on a presumption that the father would get custody, then for a long period, the mother. And Brian, in very recent history, facing that presumption, even on the forms he had to fill out.
Right. And that is so true. And a lot of what we track the trends in the uptick of shared custody to is, I don't think Brian's example necessarily highlights this, but a move and a change in sort of social and legal perspectives, courts preferring joint custody for a long time. Wisconsin has been sort of more progressive than the nation in pursuing this sort of joint physical custody as a presumption. And it's kind of dovetailed with a cultural shift that recognizes the import of father involvement in child rearing, and a push for, you know, more balanced roles after divorce. And that's you sort of in line with what some of our sort of EU counterparts have done for quite some time in thinking about sort of the mother and the father as having sort of more equivalent roles to be earners or laborers, if you will, and carers, both responsible for bringing income into the home and both responsible for caring for the child, sort of a more egalitarian perspective. And so I think the trend suggests that there will come a time, hopefully soon, where that is not the interaction that fathers have with the system, and that you're not congratulated for doing what you feel you ought to do to care for your child, for sure. But I think I've interacted with a lot of fathers who echo your sentiments, and I think that's something that should be hopefully, you know, phased out based on the data that we see and the trends and the commonality of fathers like you who really want to care for their children.
Thanks a lot for that. Thanks a lot for that call, Brian. Aaron joins us now in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi there. I'm just wondering, so as the stats show that your guest is referencing, as sort of this whole family court system moves toward the presumption of joint custody being in the best interest of kids, I'm wondering if your guest has any ideas on special considerations in cases of domestic violence. So particularly when you hear from survivors about being in really unsafe custody arrangements where they're sharing custody with an abusive ex-partner, and even in cases in which there are criminal convictions against the other parent, I think when one parent brings up a legitimate concern about violence or abuse or safety, they are often viewed by the family court system as high conflict or told in an explicit way that they should not be bringing these concerns up. Just wondering what your guest had to say on that issue.
Aaron, thanks. An important point, Quentin. How does domestic violence figure into these decisions?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And a lot of times when we write about these issues, we write, you know, shared care is the presumption. And, you know, courts would lean in that direction, except in the cases would be the hope of domestic violence, or except in the case where parents A or parent B, for whatever reason, weren't going to be able to interact with their child or the associated parent in a sort of more reasonable way. And so I think, like I said, parental conflict is, and that's not domestic violence per se, but parental conflict is such an important dimension. And so insofar as a parent has demonstrated a level of abuse or violence, I mean, you could imagine that would impact your level of agreement on various issues. I would say that is a situation where the recommendations should lean in the direction of a sole custody arrangement wherein parent A or parent B, the custodial parent, you know, cared for the child at least 75% of the time.
Aaron,
so I think there are certain cases where sole custody makes a lot of sense. And we can talk, you know, there are advantages and disadvantages to both, mm-hmm. even outside of looking at domestic violence cases. And you know, the literature is actually quite mixed as to what type of custody arrangement lends to, you know, improvements in outcomes. Anyway, so there's a lot to unpack that we can unpack.
Aaron, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last minute or so, Quentin, I wanted to ask about, we saw some of you and your colleagues' work referenced in an Atlantic article that said, that pointed out, you know, the data you have, the increase in joint custody, but the rest of the world, the rest of our system not keeping up, and the idea that, you know, the schools want to deal with one address, and child support and public assistance programs want to deal with one address. Just briefly, our system's keeping up with this increase in joint custody.
The short answer is no. They're not keeping up with this. So when you look at most cross-national or within country data sets, when you look at, you know, OECD data or census data, a lot of times when we're tracking children, we're sort of allocating them to one home. Like, what home is the residence of this child? There's one. So in a shared custody arrangement, you can imagine if it's an equal sort of split care, that it would stand to reason that maybe this child should be, you know, 50% of this home for the sake of, you know, taxes, for the sake of economic supports, child maintenance, and 50% in this home. But our systems currently allow for a child to be in one place at one time. And you can think of all of the sort of negative implications for one parent or the other parent when you can only sort of count the child in one place in a given time frame. And so I think it, you can imagine the administrative burden and the sort of complex calculus that would come along with sort of splitting a child between homes sort of proportionally. But I think it's sort of necessary to ensure that parents have, you know, the supports they need in order to rear children. And kind of briefly here.
Just a few moments left.
Okay. Yeah. And so, like, when you think about custodial parents, they have access to multiple supports. You know, they have access to child tax credits and earned income tax credits and WIC and TANF and child support enforcement services, SNAP. And when you look at non-custodial parents, they generally don't have access to much. They're honestly treated by our systems as non-parents.
And that's where we'll leave it. Thanks to Quentin Reiser with UW-Madison's Department of Human Development and Family Studies, looking at an increase in children under joint parental custody.